Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
22 months have passed since the night Bryce's life was changed forever. With a carefree party girl exterior, Bryce has changed in ways that many don't even see. After a frustrating business meeting at her old haunt, interrupted by none other than her brother, Bryce's life has changed once again when a visit from Micah, Hunt, and Isaiah reveals that Danica's murderer is not who they once thought. The demon-summoning murderer is back and has found another victim. Their only lead? Bryce Quinlan. While Bryce agrees to help find Danica's killer, Hunt discovers that his own freedom is at stake. His only path forward, working with Bryce to find the perpetrator.
The views expressed by the hosts are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author.
This podcast is a discussion shared to spark thought and conversation on the characters and themes of this novel.
The interpretations presented in this podcast are just a few of the many possibilities. Listeners are encouraged to read along and share their own analysis of the text.
Though the hosts speak mostly within the constraints of this book, series and extended universe spoilers may be discussed with or without warning.
Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, depression, self-harm, and death will recur throughout this podcast. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a podcast where we deep dive into the writing of your favorite novels.
This season, we're exploring Sarah J. Maas's first installment in the Crescent City series.
This is Jack.
And I'm Amy. This is part one of this week's episode. Stick around for part two, which releases on Thursday.
This week, we're discussing chapters 8 through 13 in A House of Earth and Blood.
This week, we ask ourselves, are Bryce and Hunt's motivations for finding the killer as simple as they seem, or is something lurking deep beneath the surface?
Themes we'll see in this section are self-inflicted pain as well as free will.
We start chapter 8, 22 months after Danica's death.
And I don't know about you, but I'm feeling 22 months later. You can't use 22.
You just can't. You know Taylor Swift is going to come up.
At this point, SJM's trying.
Probably, yeah. So let's start with an angel number, because why 22? 22 is an angel number, means being open to love and guidance and letting these energies lead us deeper into self-awareness. Or the other interpretation is 22 is a symbol of strength, power, and I think most importantly, resilience.
Everything I was at 22.
Yeah, I was none of those things. For sure.
No, I know. We were together.
No, I know.
We were dumbasses.
I know you were being facetious.
Yeah. No, I want them to know. I want them to know the truth. So why 22 months? It was very thought out. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because it's not quite 2 years, right?
Right.
But enough time has passed where you can establish a new life with new habits. Mm-hmm. You've already passed the holidays. You've passed birthdays, right? Like all these big things have already happened twice at this point.
Right.
So whether Bryce has consciously accepted or not, she has accepted that this life with Danica's murder behind bars, with this life without her friends, is the new life now. She's come to accept that. But it's not so far away that she's beyond grief anymore.
Yeah.
So I just think it was like very thought out and a well-chosen time jump.
And I obviously SJM is being deliberate here, but she's still young enough.
Yeah.
To make some really stupid mistakes.
Yeah.
Or poor assumptions. And so she still remains, to me, almost a little naive.
25, frontal lobe is done, but still not smart.
Still not smart. What are our perceptions of Bryce going into this chapter? I think we enter this chapter reinforcing everything Hunt and Isaiah believed about Bryce, even though we may have thought a little bit differently about her in part one. Bryce is having sex, even though she's meeting up for a job in a bathroom at the White Raven, and it screams party girl, regardless of her intentions. For her to be like, yep, just hooked up in the bathroom. Oops, I'm 2 minutes late for a job. It's a little uncomfortable for someone who's not a party girl. I also want to point out that the shifter that she chooses to have sex with is a lion. And I thought that was an interesting choice when you compare to a wolf, because a wolf is from the dog-ish family. Lion is from the cat-ish family. It's the complete opposite. And I felt like that was deliberate.
I love it.
So, although we will learn this chapter that Bryce has been stone cold sober since Danica's death, I think she's using sex as a tool to escape her past. Quote, Bryce had been in such need of a distraction from the tension building in her with each moment in the White Raven. Sex for Bryce right now is a form of power or control. And I think the more Bryce becomes willing to confront the past, she's not going to have sex as a form of escapism. And I think that might explain why Bryce and Hunt don't actually do the deed this novel. Like, they don't go all the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's deliberate on SJM's part, because Bryce is still healing while also willing to confront what's been happening.
I agree. I think that it is totally purposeful, but I'm going to view it slightly different. I don't think it's as much as an escape as it is a punishment because she's back at the White Raven. She's already established that this is not a place that she normally goes to.
Yeah.
And I think that she's kind of recreating that night for her. Yeah. Now, I have a couple of clues to this. The first one being is the fact that it's a lion, like you pointed out. We know that the night of Danica's death, she hooked up with someone in the bathroom there, right? But we don't know who. Mm-hmm. We didn't know until the next morning later on where it's like, get out of the bathroom.
Right.
Stop fucking people. Right. There's only one other group, like men in that night that showed interest in Bryce. Mountain lions.
I was going to say, were they jaguars?
No,
they were
mountain lions because they were rawr.
Rawr.
Yeah. So she was, it could have been, in theory, a mountain lion shifter that she hooked up with that night. Mm-hmm. And now here she is with a lion. But either way, like, this club, she's not drinking. It's bringing back memories. It's, you know, a lot of PTSDs happening. And even though we know that this is like the best sex that she's had in 3 months, like, there's still not enough data, you know,
right.
Like, you know, is she comparing it to vibrators? Is she comparing it to maybe one other person? What's the, you know, maybe she did sleep with some other people, but at the same time, it might not have been a bathroom situation. It could have been a lot of other things. So I think that's also part of the reason why she doesn't sleep with Hunt is a punishment to herself.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we're going to talk a lot about punishing ourselves or herself in this episodes.
So yeah.
I completely.
Literature's fun.
I can see your point.
Yeah. And I can see your point.
I want to acknowledge that there's a moment where when Bryce turns down the lion shifter from like spending more time with him, he somehow automatically assumes that means she's an escort.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered in this moment when I read the book, does he assume that because she's human?
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, it totally has racism vibes for me.
Yeah.
Like you make a really, really negative assumption about someone just because of the way they look.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I loved it because I was like, well, that's a hell of a jump, right? Like,
yeah.
Oh, you don't want to sleep with me? I can't pay for you. It's like, excuse, what? I don't. No, sir. That's not the jump. So I can totally see the elements of racism there. And that's interesting because my mom has been confused as a sex worker a number of times in her life.
Oh, wow.
She does wear, she's a hottie, you know, and she loves.
She's showing, a hottie with a body.
Yeah. And she loves showing off her body. But like, you know, there's one way, there's no like one way that sex workers look, you know what I mean? And if that's how you dress, that's how you dress. But my mother is Hispanic and she looks Hispanic. So that idea of like race, like racism mixed into that. But I also can very much see this, like from the feminist perspective, looking at it as like Vanir, who are just so like, you know, full of themselves. Mm-hmm. Can't even, this man can't even imagine a woman not interested.
Right.
So there has to be a reason. So I also interpret it as a
misogyny.
Just, yeah, like the
audacity.
Yeah. That's what this is. This is just the sheer audacity.
He's being audacious.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to say, I have to give it to Bryce. You know, she's a good sport about it. She laughs about it. And she's not offended because, as she says later, she has respect for sex workers. Mm-hmm. But to confront that assumption with humor is mind-boggling to me.
Right? Well, I'm trying to think if I've been confused as a sex worker. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've been waiting for it.
Oh, you're like, please.
Kind of. Not in a so I can lash out, but just like, which is insulting. Because I've worn things.
Yeah.
I should have been confused.
You're like, it's a compliment to be assumed.
Well, I'm just like, how dare you think I'd give this away for free?
That's fair. Along those lines, we have a lot of visual cues within the White Raven that are upholding that Vanir versus human status that Jack is talking about and that kind of entitlement. Bryce is supposed to meet Tertian, her, I was going to call him a work colleague, which is why I paused. I'm like, he's not a colleague.
It's Maxie.
He doesn't like to be called Max.
All right.
Maximus Tertian.
Maxie the vampy.
Bryce is supposed to meet him on the mezzanine bar. And let's talk about this mezzanine bar. There's a golden staircase leading up to it, and the bar itself is completely made of gold. There are no humans present except for Bryce, and in her mind, she says, if I even counted. There is a huge world of difference between, apparently, the main floor and this mezzanine bar.
Yeah.
And I find it curious for Bryce to not even count herself as human in this instance,
mm-hmm.
even though she mostly identifies as human. I think she knows she's too passing to really count as human.
Yeah. It's funny when you wrote that. When I read it, I was like, I can relate. In the sense that I am Hispanic, but I am so white passing.
Yes, you are.
That I identify as white.
I thought of you too when I wrote that.
Oh my God, thank you. It was because I've talked about that a lot with you. And that's like the thing is with, it's the duality of self, right? I mean, it's that balance of having to accept yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And understand that you are both, regardless of what people see you. And you can claim a heritage that maybe others don't see in you right mm-hmm. off the bat, right? Because they've said that her ears and her stillness are really the only things that give her away.
Right. Everything else about her body is wrong, quote unquote.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So it's, you know, she's having to figure that out. And ultimately, like, still, at this point, she's never enough even in her own eyes,
mm-hmm.
even though she knows that men, including Vampy Max, like, they want her. And, like, but at the same time, I'm happy that she doesn't feel enough because she's not using the men's validation to feel like enough.
Yeah, that's a great point. Either Max's interest in her or the line shifter and the sex she just had, like, that doesn't validate her in this moment.
Yeah, which I'm like, I'm happy you feel worthless.
Because the men you should feel worthwhile in and of yourself, not because of other men's.
But yeah, like, it's just kind of like, you know, she feels like shit, but like, good job for not going like, oh, at least they want me.
Right. Basically, I think what you're trying to say is accepting Maximus and the line shifter's validation of her mm-hmm. would be false.
Exactly. And she's also like, she's just so good about not falling into men.
Yeah.
And the patriarchy.
Yeah.
So it's like, hey, I'm going to have my issues and they will not have to do with you.
Yeah.
Unless they're my daddy issues. We'll get to that later.
I want to go back to something you said, Jack, earlier, that Bryce is reliving the night of Danica's death. And I see that in other ways other than the sex in the bathroom, although mm-hmm. I now see that as a reliving of the previous night. Bryce can't escape her past in other ways as well. She avoids looking at the booth that she and her friends used to have all the time when they came to the White Raven. That's the same booth where she had fun with Fury and Juniper when Danica was killed. She also observes a group of women with first light glow sticks who, it wasn't the exact same woman, but there was another group of women we saw the night of Danica's death. So those are all visual cues that are reminding Bryce of the night of Danica's death. I have to acknowledge that SJM takes a very long beat to talk about the drop while Bryce is waiting for Maximus to read his bill or his invoice for the artifact he just bought. And it's like 2 pages long.
Yeah, it's a long time.
When people complain about world building, I see it more in this section than I did in our first or second episode. Because there are times where our quote-unquote narrator gets lost in thought while they're waiting for other action to happen. And they take 2 pages to explain something. And it is in context of their surroundings, but it's not really relevant.
No, I mean, but like at the same time, we're 8 chapters in and we've talked about the drop so many times.
Right.
Like, we got to know what this is.
Yeah, that's true.
But you're right, where it's like, I like to imagine that this is a personal attack on slow readers like myself. Maybe she just really had a long time to fill while Max was reading everything.
Fair. Maybe the invoice was really, really complicated.
Could have been simple, Amy. All right. Some of us are just slow readers.
It's true. I want to point out a fun tidbit. When talking about the drop or when thinking about the drop, we learned that the drop activity and first light is tracked by the Eleusinian system. I think this is perhaps a reference to the Greek Eleusinian Mysteries, which is a cult of Persephone and I always want to say Demeter, but I think it's Demeter, that performed secret rituals and initiations. According to Wikipedia, I know not the most accurate source, but
that's pretty good.
That's where my research went.
Yeah.
The Mysteries represented the myth of the abduction of Persephone from her mother, Demeter, by the king of the underworld, Hades, in a cycle with 3 phases, the descent, the search, and the ascent. For the initiated, the rebirth of Persephone symbolized the eternity of life, which flows from generation to generation, and they believed that they would have a reward in the afterlife, which I thought was just a cool representation of the drop, because you drop, you descend, and then you ascend.
Like, literally,
and,
is it?
And then you are immortal. Like,
yeah, no, that's fair.
SJM's very,
that is
very
actually
clever.
Like, really. She's not even trying, but
she's not even trying.
Like, that's the thing. It's like, it's genius in the simplicity.
Yeah, because who takes the time to look this stuff up?
I guarantee it's not me.
Not usually me, unless I'm doing a podcast.
Right.
I do also wonder if, even though it's a literal representation of the actual drop that the citizens are going through, I do wonder to what extent it is or it can be extrapolated to the Asteri and their process for taking over a civilization.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun. I also want to acknowledge that it's exactly 6 minutes to perform the drop. If you don't come out of the drop within 6 minutes, you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
Six is the most powerful number in numerology because it is the smallest perfect number.
Oh.
If you don't know what a perfect number is, look it up online. I don't want to explain it right now. As an angel number, six represents the balance in the material and spiritual aspects of life, which also feels relevant to this idea of gaining immortality. So, thought it was fun. And it is good information to have. I feel like it will come back somehow.
Somehow. Some way. I love the beginning and end of all of this information, right? Like you were saying, Bryce sees these party girls, right? And we're kind of, it's kind of like the bookmark beginning of this explanation of what is the drop, right? She says these, you know, the party girls with their glow sticks, which are basically made out of first light.
Yeah.
And you kind of start to realize in the explanation of like, wait, this first light, it powers everything.
Yeah.
You've heard it a few times now.
Right.
The first light of the lamps, the first light of this, like everything's powered by first light to the point where even glow sticks are powered by it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you almost imagine it as electricity, right? There's a little frivolousness about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to see what it's made out of. The fact that people almost die in order to get first light. Then it seems like a totally frivolous thing to, you get a, like a little vial, right, of your own first light. And you get to do whatever you want with it. And it's just, it feels like throwing away cash.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, think about in those other, in the parts of this world where there's war, right? Or human colonies where they need something to power something. And Bryce even says that when she was going to make the drop with Danica, she was planning on getting a glow stick and keychain that said, "Kiss my sparkly ass."
Yeah. And which is, Danica wanted shot glasses.
Right. Like, which I'm like, man, at a first light, that actually sounds kind of cool. But it's just like, it shows how the contradiction between how wasteful that is and how people are throwing this around. It makes sense when you think about, like, this is a really random place to put this information. But it's also a great juxtaposition between the waste of it and what it costs to get it.
Yeah. I think that's a wonderful point. And it almost, I think, in a way subdues the reader into being like, oh, this is fine. This isn't that big of a deal. Just like everyone else is thinking.
Yep.
And it disguises the true nature of what's going on, the insidiousness of it.
Yeah.
Which is, I just got goosebumps. Like, good job, SJM. Like,
it is.
I'm here complaining about how much information you're giving me when really it's extremely important.
Yeah.
And it parallels what's going to happen at the end of the novel.
It's really important stuff.
Yeah. And it's just a lovely bookend.
It is.
Except this is the book start, not the bookend.
Like 25-ish. Like, I'd say we're 20%-ish.
Is that right? 12%.
12, this is a big book.
I mentioned earlier Bryce's sense of humor. And we're going to see throughout this novel how she uses humor and other flirtatious mannerisms to disarm people. Here specifically, we see her wink. It's flirty. It's not offensive. And when that fails, she uses lies as a quick backup. And it doesn't feel like an attack, but it still is a weapon that she arms herself with. And she's always ready. And I really admire that. I wish I could be her. That's my Bryce-ism, is just how quick she is to be unassuming, fly under the radar, just be kind of cute and coy.
Yeah.
Because it's so important to understand that that's her personality and that's her weapon because she uses it all the time.
Yeah. She kind of reminds me in this moment, you know, like those, you kind of see the people on the, they're trying to scam you and they have like three cups or four cups and they're moving the cups around really fast and you have to guess which one the has the prize. And that's what kind of feels like what's happening, where she's moving around all these cups and you don't know if you're getting a flirtatious moment or a or an
sarcastic
insult, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we know, but dumbass Max does not.
Yes.
Even to the point where she buys him a drink, right? Like, she's like, drinks on me. Like, she's asserting power dominance in the sense of, like, you know, taking on the traditionally masculine tropes and stuff, like, oh, I got your drink, toots. But at the same time, she's flirting, she's winking, she's not interested. Oh, I'm sure you say that to all the girls.
Right.
You know, but it's like, it's a clever balance, and she's doing these moves and juggling all of it perfectly.
Yeah. It makes me wonder where SJM learned all this. Is this SJM? Is she this disarming? Because if she is, she's like a triple threat.
I would like really be scared if she was. Yeah, like, I was ready to be like, no, this can't be her. This,
I know, I saw your face and you're like,
panic, just sheer panic.
Now, even though Bryce is being flirty and a little bit disarming, I feel that her encounter with Maximus is forcing her to acknowledge some of her resentment of her humanity. And I think I see it most in this quote. Quote, Bryce met Maximus's stare, hating that some small part of her wanted to recoil, that it recognized him as a predator and her as his prey, and she'd be lucky to even get the chance to run before she was eaten whole. When Bryce slips away later, she also thinks, quote, at least her fey heritage was good for moving quickly when necessary. Like earlier, we're seeing Bryce compare the two sides of herself without comparing the two sides of herself directly. And I feel like the human side is not winning right now. She seems to really not pride that humanity within her. Between this and not considering herself human when she first got to the bar, I wonder if this is a signal that Bryce blames her humanity on Danica's death.
I love that question, because I would say that the way that she refers to herself now does feel different to the way she referred to herself before. And even if it was subtle as like, you know, not that she like loved herself before, you know, she kept talking about having the wrong body type and stuff, but there was still a celebration of her body, which again is a celebration of her humanity. Now, she's wearing short clothes. She knows that she looks good, but I wouldn't call it the celebration like it was before.
Right.
And I do agree that there's a fair amount of not, yeah, like she's not talking about the human side as much. And that is the side that let Danica die. She didn't let Danica die at all. We're talking about her mind.
Yeah, yeah. She didn't let Danica die, but I'm sure on some level
she feels it.
She feels it. If she was more fey and she could have moved faster or gotten more sober or whatever the case is, I'm sure she has spun so many different false narratives about the night of Danica's death that she does blame herself on some level.
Mm-hmm.
To me, and I don't know if this even makes any sense, but in my mind, as I was thinking about this, I was like, well, we can blame her humanity for why the line shifter just assumed she was an escort.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't hate that part of her humanity or that assumption because it has nothing to do with Danica.
Mm-hmm.
She only hates the part of her human side that she might believe, this is all me guessing, she might believe contributed to Danica's death.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to point that out, because if she hates her human side, why didn't she react negatively to being?
Oh, I have. So the reason why I think that, because the Vanir sex workers are still half Vanir. That's how it's described.
You're right.
So I don't think that it's her humanity being called out there.
Oh, interesting.
Because you still have, and the way that they've talked about sex workers, it's the half Vanir. Granted, you have to be half human, but like,
but it's, they focus not on the Vanir side.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's why it didn't stand out to her too much then.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you for making that make more sense to me.
You know, I love these conversations.
At this point, Rune Danin, Crown Prince of the Valbaran Fae, enters the scene. And I love Rune, A, because I feel like he and I have a lot in common.
Really? I love this. I want to know more.
Oh, I don't know if I want to describe it in the podcast.
Okay, we'll talk another time.
But let's focus on his appearance. Rune's appearance in particular, to me, is a symbol of defiance and is a symbol of him trying to take control of his life. He, even though he's the prince and the quote-unquote chosen one, he's very ostentatious in an unprincely sort of way. It's almost undignified, but I think it's sexy. He's got tattooed sleeves. They're colorful. He's got earrings. He has hair that flows to his waist, but one side is shaved. Like, it's sexy.
He's so seen.
He's so seen?
Yeah.
Is that a slang? I don't know.
Yeah, like back in the day when they're seen. God, you were in China.
I'm sorry.
I can't look at you.
He is a scene? The scene?
No. No.
How, spell scene for me.
I don't know. They're like, they're, you know, scene. original, it's not, it's like the cross between emo and goth. That's how I would describe.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
All right, we'll circle back to that another time.
I gotta look up Urban Dictionary.
Do we do a quick Urban Dictionary Google?
Okay.
Yeah, it's like the early...
Oh my gosh. Okay. According to Urban Dictionary, seen as a subculture that is spreading around quite quickly. This was written in 2009, by the way. These people wear brightly colored clothing such as graphic tees, skinny jeans, childish bows, and neon makeup. They usually have a taste for Hello Kitty, Gloomy Bear, dinosaurs, robots, rainbows, stars, and polka dots.
Okay, like...
You are so seen.
That's seen.
Oh, that's not emo?
That's it. Again, it's like, it's seen before emo fully.
Okay.
Seen was the thing. And then, I mean, it is emo, but you would just say like, they're so, like, it's just another way of saying it.
Got it.
But okay. The reason why Rune is seen to me is because his tattoos are colorful.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like there's, even though he's like, you know, wearing black jeans, I'm very happy we did Google this. I'm like surprised about
I'm this impressed.
Info. Of me knowing things?
Yes.
I mean, I was cool. No, I wasn't. I was so far from that. But like, yeah, like to me, he is the definition of scene, where he kind of has these like bad boy rock elements, but he has those like really you know, bright tattoos at the same time.
Honestly, I'm surprised he doesn't have a streak of bright electric blue in his hair to match his eyes.
Oh, God, he should.
Shouldn't he?
He really should.
He really should.
As you said it, I'm realizing that that has always been in my head. It hasn't, but now it has. It feels like it has been, you know?
Later, Bryce will think, quote, Rune hadn't yet fallen in line then, hadn't bought into his chosen one greatness. And I think, even though she doesn't say it, I think she's secretly proud of him. Even though they have this terrible history and we don't understand any of it yet, but that's the subtext I read in this moment.
Yeah.
And just, I think she connects with it because she's rebellious too.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she does connect with him in a lot of ways. Like, even though she kind of teases him for, not teases, more like giving him shit, but like for not being in his normal rock bar, she and Rune are kind of similar in the vibes of how they dress, where like both are wearing clothes that show them off,
mm-hmm.
right? Like she's wearing short dress. He's wearing, you know, muscles, like muscle tee, and like, I'm sure jeans that make his ass look great. This is a fictional character. Why am I drooling? Both siblings like to show off their body. And even though Bryce is confused as a sex worker, Rune's body's celebrated,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, people don't stop and ask him how much he costs, unless it was me who was there. Rune even comments on her outfit at one point, saying, like, see that you're still happy playing slutty secretary. Like, what the fuck? What kind of comment is that?
Yeah, it definitely, we know because we've read the whole book, it feeds into the reason for their fight from the past.
No, absolutely. Like, and he's doing this on purpose.
Absolutely.
And Rune feels comfortable to slut shame Bryce going after her appearance. Immediately, there's some regret on his part because of what he's about to say, and I'll get into that. But it just sucks because, you know, he calls her like, you know, a slutty secretary. And she's like, the next line is like, we used to be best friends.
Yep.
And I think that he must have, like, in my mind, he must have seen that on her face, because at that point he admits that he showed up because Risso told him that Max was getting handsy. He knows what time Bryce has to get up to go to work, 6 a.m. Like, how do you know that? He says that he's going to make sure that their dad cares about what happens to Bryce. And then he follows her home, like the gentle stalker that he is, to make sure that she gets home safe. And at this point, it's like, bro, pick a lane.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel for Rune, because one thing that is very obvious to me about Bryce in this chapter especially is how narrow her viewpoint is of everyone and everything around her.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of bitterness and resentment that comes through in Bryce's point of view. And so it's hard to really see the true Rune in this moment because everything is through the Bryce lens.
Yeah.
And Bryce's lens is tainted.
Yeah.
And we know more about Rune because luckily we get some of his perspective throughout this novel and the next novel. And my heart hurts for them because I think it's obvious from here, regardless of how Bryce views it, he cares.
Yeah.
And she won't let him. And she just eggs him on until he has his negative reactions.
Yep.
Because that's what siblings do.
I'm happy you point that out because I'm about to lose a lot of our listeners at this point. And I apologize. But you and I have talked about this. The sexual tension between these two.
I know.
It's like, why are you making me root to find out that they're actually not related?
SJM does it on purpose.
Yeah.
It's a fake love triangle that she's trying to create.
Or you and I are broken.
We're broken.
That's most likely. That too. They do establish pretty quickly that's her brother.
Yeah.
But God, like, I don't want them to be related just so I can have the scene that I want.
Sorry. You're not getting it.
Game of Thrones messed me up, man.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, because I'm like, they're half siblings. It's
fine.
It's not fine. I know this about me, guys. I'm sorry, but you just have two hot characters. And at one point, she's like, she says something about, like, their dad. And she goes, oh, like, still, like, something like, did daddy get you? And I was like, throw that towards Rune. Call him daddy.
Look, I ship Rune with someone else. Did I think it was, like, did I enjoy the tension the first time I read it? Absolutely.
Yeah,
no, yes, I did.
I was really surprised of where that went, too. I was like, oh, wait, no, so they're still related.
Yeah, they're still related.
Okay, cool.
But, y'all, They're fake characters. We don't actually promote this kind of stuff.
Just the warning. Hey, guys. I want you to know we don't promote incest.
This is all fake.
This is all fake. We don't promote incest. No, I hope you know this about us.
During this interaction with Rune, I think that we see a baseline for Bryce's life. Quote, none of her smiles reached her eyes these days. Quote, she'd been up before dawn again, sweat-soaked and breathless, and the day hadn't improved from there. Maybe she'd be exhausted enough tonight to actually sleep. That says a lot in a little bit of time mm-hmm. about Bryce and who she is, and that does not sound like the person we met in part one.
No.
We also get this sense of bitterness that I mentioned earlier. We see it towards Fury. Quote, too bad Fury didn't answer her calls for Bryce to even ask about it. And even towards Rune. Quote, there had never been a door shut for him, not once in his entire life.
I snapped.
Shocked me. I'm shooketh from your snap. And I bring this up because this is all pre-Hunt and pre-facing the past. This is all Bryce with unresolved grief, mm-hmm. unresolved guilt, and
living in limbo.
And it's important for us to set this baseline because her growth is massive.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to point that out for all of us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We learn at this point that Rune was ordered by the Autumn King to keep an eye on Bryce. Quote, I was just ordered to tell you to not get into trouble until the summit is over. That's book speak for basically this is exactly what's going to happen. She's going to get in trouble before the summit, in case you didn't understand that.
I just want to lay down the plot for you real fast in this one simple sentence.
Exactly. Now, how does Bryce feel about that? Quote, the glass in her hands cracked. She couldn't stop clutching the glass, couldn't get her body to back down from the primal fury that surged up. The heavy crystal glass exploded in her hands. Now, this crystal glass strikes me as extremely expensive. It makes me think of the crystal chandelier from The Pearl and Rose in Chapter 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that this might be a stretch, but this feels symbolic to me in a number of ways. The Autumn King, the head of the Fae, is telling her brother, the prince, to keep an eye on her and telling her what to do. And Bryce doesn't own her heritage. Mm-hmm. She doesn't own being a princess. So, like, who has the right? So for her to clutch this glass and let it explode, A, feels like a rebellious act. Not intentionally, but it feels symbolic of, like, fuck you.
Yeah.
As well as just fuck you in general to hierarchy, which I think we're going to see more of with Bryce.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to point out that little act.
Yeah. When you were reading the quote, it just kind of gave me almost like a teaser to her almost passing up her father's power
mm-hmm.
when she makes the jump. Like just the way that it was described as that primal fury that surged up,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's just like, it just kind of was like, ooh, you're going to give your father a run for his money.
Yeah, we do see a lot of that Fae heritage come through when she's angry mm-hmm. and it's most often sparked by her father or her yeah. brother. And I do think that that's a deliberate choice on SJM's yep. part. So I do think in this moment, I might be grasping at straws, but we're seeing so much foreshadowing take place throughout these chapters that I felt like this particular moment was also a foreshadowing and just really demonstrates Bryce's unwillingness to fall in line, mm-hmm. regardless of who's telling her what to do. When she breaks the glass, Rune tells Bryce to calm down and, quote, that horrible, useless face side obeyed the dominance in his command. It's ironic to me because the face side was useful earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because Bryce is not fully fae, she will never be able to have that dominance, right?
Yeah.
Her brother, her father will always dominate her. And it just creates this really awful power dynamic between the three of them. The Autumn King lords over both mm-hmm. Rune and Bryce. Bryce rebels and tries to lord over Rune. And Rune's just the middleman. He's yeah. got no choices here.
Leave him alone. Also, I'm going to need a sample of that dominance, that dominating voice. I just want to see how that feels, where I can't even resist. I'm just a brat. You know, we're talking about Bryce and what she's struggling with and, you know, poor Daddy Rune. I'll come up with a good name for him. Rooney Dad.
Zaddy Rune.
Rudy. Ratty. But really, though, is it these men? Is it the veneer, or is it really the patriarchy? And the reason why I bring that in is because Bryce was more than okay with Danica being in charge. Mm-hmm. She, I'll even say, liked Danica being in charge.
Yeah.
She liked Danica making these choices for her. And, you know, there might be times where you can probably go back and say, like, no, she wasn't happy all the time, but she let Danica make a lot of life choices. So it's fair to say that I think that this also shows Bryce's distrust for men. Mm. First, the Autumn King let her down. I mean, let her mom down, really.
Yeah.
And then let Bryce down.
Yeah.
And then Rune's going to let her down.
Yeah.
And it's not so much about accepting the masculine. Like, I don't think that Bryce's journey is like the way we talked about it in ACOTAR, where we talked about like Feyre and her journey of accepting mm-hmm. the masculine and the feminine. Bryce is such a feminine energy.
Yeah.
And I don't think she has trouble with the masculine necessarily. I think she has trouble with the man part of the masculine.
Yeah, but because, I mean, she likes the masculine. She's attracted to masculine men.
Yeah. And she has moments where she's like ready, you know, break a glass in her hand. That's mm-hmm. a very masculine. I'll argue that's a very masculine thing. You're yeah. going to have a man throwing his fist into a wall.
Right.
Breaking glass.
Right.
And there isn't that moment of shame necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
It's just more of an association with her father.
Yeah.
And brother.
Yeah. That's a great point. All of this to say, Rune and Bryce, we're going to see throughout this novel, they both rebel against their father in their own ways. But like I said, Rune has less choices than Bryce does because of his public association, and Bryce has that freedom because she is not yet known to mm-hmm. the world. And we're going to see a lot of power dynamics, not only between all three of them, but these power dynamics are going to be completely different by the end of this novel. And it's really, really well done in my yeah. point of view. And I'm really excited to talk about that. Before we finish up this chapter, we see again Bryce try to use lies both as weapon and shield. And she does this with her brother specifically when he tries to like show care for her. Like, mm-hmm. it's cold. Why are you dressed so scantily, apparently? Yeah. Quote, well, then it's a good thing I have my alcohol sweater on, isn't it? A lie. She hadn't touched a drink in nearly 2 years. Rune didn't know that, though, nor did anyone else. The irony to me is the fact that Bryce is starting to be really, really good at lying, which is exactly what Danica was, even though Bryce does not know it. And she's emulating Danica without knowing she's emulating Danica.
Good point.
Which is hilarious for me.
Yep.
I think, though, it's out of necessity. She lies to keep herself safe. All of her relationships are down the toilet, basically. And in order to avoid more grief,
mm-hmm.
you avoid people. Like, don't yeah. form more relationships, then you can never lose relationships. And it's really, really tragic to see her doing this. But in some ways, Danica was doing the same thing with her lies. She was keeping Bryce safe, even though, you know, she didn't really keep her at arm's length. Oh, well.
Yeah. I also just love the use of alcohol sweater,
mm-hmm.
mainly because I have 100% done that, where yeah. it's like, it's cold, it's raining, I'm gonna take a couple shots.
Yeah, yeah, I'll be fine.
I won't care in a little bit. I also love that, again, in this moment, Bryce is using clothing, metaphorical clothing, but is using clothing as an armor.
Mm-hmm.
It's metaphorical clothing with metaphorical armor, but feminizing the weapons.
Yeah, that's a great point. I also wanted to acknowledge the little nuggets of brilliance that SJM leaves for us. When Bryce gets home, we learn that she has a lilac oil diffuser in mm-hmm. her apartment. And in aromatherapy, lilac oil is used to calm the mind and spirit, balance emotions, and inspire peace. And Bryce is anxious, so it makes sense that that's what she chose. I also want to point out that Feyre smells like lilac.
I did not remember that.
It's everywhere.
Okay.
It's everywhere in the Court of Thorns and Roses series. And I just, There's no reason for me to bring that up other than the fact that I think SJM really likes Lilac.
If we were friends with SJM for the third book, because again, we haven't, the third book hasn't come out yet in this timeline of when this is released. Mm. If we were friends with her, I'd send her a bouquet of lilacs.
No, oh, that's very nice of you.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, another little tidbit, again, going into Bryce's mental state is the idea of like how many locks are involved and how in depth they are.
Yeah.
Just little moments.
I can't remember. Do we know that she put those in or did Danica already have those installed?
We don't know though that yet.
Okay.
And I think we find out that she adds more locks later.
Okay. I would believe you.
Yeah. But like, it just kind of, you know, there's that PTSD involved.
Yeah. Like chapter 8, the opening of chapter 9 reinforces beliefs we've adopted from other perspectives. This time, however, it's about Hunt. Even though we're getting Hunt's point of view, we're going to believe certain things about Hunt based on Isaiah's point of view from chapter 6.
So before Amy goes into Hunt's point of view, I just kind of want to jump in real fast. And I want to talk about the writing style, because Hunt's point of view is so important in this beginning and then going into this chapter, because this little blurb at the beginning is roughly a page long and it's really detached and it's all third person. Right. But this isn't like a focused third person. It's almost like a really removed third person.
Yeah.
And then it goes into Hunt, and Hunt is still detached, but not as detached from before. So go ahead and dive back into it. But I just wanted to talk about the writing style and tell you how SJM is preparing us for all these insights that Amy's about to point out.
Yeah, SJM does such a great job in this section in conveying that disassociative state that Hunt is in. First off, he's in the middle of killing, so we're reinforcing this idea that he's a vicious killer. I don't think it ever outrightly states that his victims are human, but we know that they're human because he's in Asphodel Meadows, which is where all the humans live.
Wait, what?
It mentions he's in the meadows, and that's Asphodel Meadows, and we learn from the beginning of the book. Yes.
All right. Well, that blew my mind.
So there's very little information, but the information that is there is enough to glean what's going on here. And this is important to me because Hunt does nothing to observe the humanity of his victims. Mm-hmm. He makes it extremely impersonal. The only bit of information that we get about the victim is one that is extremely negative and one that we regularly connect to humanity, and that is urine. It is bodily fluids. Quote, the male's terror filled the room, overpowering the scent of blood. Its reek as bad as stale piss in an alley. At this point, this victim is basically a rat. Like, stale piss, alley makes me think of rodents. And it's just another sign of disassociation that this male isn't even anywhere close to being the same species as Hunt. And, you know, just this makes me think of all of our Court of Thorns and Roses series episodes where if Feyre's bowels were watery or if someone peed themselves or puked themselves, that meant they were human because it shows weakness. Even though this is terrible, I think it's really poetic that we're finding both Bryce and Hunt in situations where they are as far away as possible from their true selves and they're only exerting power out of necessity. In their situation, Bryce is having sex to forget the past. Bryce is using lies and humor to get away from Maximus, to get away from her brother, while his Hunt is killing because he's been told to, and it's a condition of his future potential freedom. And that freedom that he seeks is because he made poor choices in the past that have gotten him enslaved. I never really noticed the parallels between the two of them in the beginning chapters, but I think it's everywhere.
Yeah.
These two are so much like each other and so much in similar situations. It makes sense why they fall for each other later.
Yeah. I mean, it also makes sense why they're mates.
Yeah.
You know, like, I do think, you know, we're going to see once they kind of get reunited, especially in this episode of like, oh, they're mates.
Yeah.
Oh, they're mates.
Yeah.
Okay. So the helmet, Hunt's fancy skull helmet. It's an interesting fashion choice. For many reasons. One, it's more than practical, right? Like, we know that it heightens his hearing, but it's also scary. Very important fact there. I just want to see a skull helmet.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it would be scary, right? If I just see this like scary person with a skull helmet come towards me, but I just would start tapping it. You annoyed yet? You mad yet? You mad yet? I mean, then he'd kill me, but like,
I think
I have,
you can bleep this out. I think you'd be,
bleep it. Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I very much so. You know me well. We also see it that it shields Hunt from his horrors.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it helps him detach.
Yeah.
Even though, ironically enough, it heightens his senses.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a line like this where it says, quote, "The visor of his helmet, speckling his line of vision as he surveyed the lone male standing." And it's both shielding him,
mm-hmm.
and it's not Hunt necessarily who's doing these killings. It's the Umbra Mortis.
Yeah.
But I just realized I've never said that out loud.
You said it right.
Thank you. But it's like that moment of like, oh shit, I've avoided it this far. I knew the time would come. But like, you know, he's able to detach from the two of them just enough. But that helmet is a really cool helmet and I'd like to see it in person.
I will also say, to me, the helmet gives the same vibes as the way Bryce dresses. Like you said, it's no longer a celebration of her body. It's her putting on a persona of what people expect from her. And that's the same for Hunt and the Umbra Mortis helmet. He's putting on this persona to do a deed.
Mm-hmm.
And when he's done with the deed, he takes off that helmet.
Yeah. I know a different deed he can do.
At the end of the day, though, the reality is that Hunt is numb. And as Jack mentioned, we still get that sense when Hunt gets back to the Comitium and he's taken off that helmet of the Umbra Mortis. It doesn't mean that all the atrocities that he's just committed have gone away, and he's still reeling from that. Justinian calls him a sick fuck, which, honestly, I hate Justinian from the get-go.
Yeah.
I'm not mad that he dies.
No.
But in response, quote, "Hunt continued toward the bathroom door. His lightning didn't so much as hiss inside him." Justinian should know better. Hunt should know that Justinian should know better. And I wonder to what extent is Hunt internalizing the things that are being said about him?
Yeah.
Because he's in a messed up situation and everyone knows he's in a messed up situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfair.
Yeah, but it's totally unfair.
He has to disassociate to survive.
Yep.
So he doesn't correct anyone, which sucks even more. Hunt explains, though, quote, "Micah didn't want a gun for this," Hunt said, his voice hollow even to his ears. And later, Hunt can barely register anybody's words. We're starting to get a sense, then, that Hunt is not a willing predator or participant in this situation. As I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of parallels between Hunt and Bryce, and I think that we're finding Hunt in a similar power struggle. Even though he's an angel and in theory he's on top of the food chain, in reality, he's owned by the archangels, he's been traded by the archangels, and he has no power. Hunt and Bryce really have no power given the situations that they're in.
Yeah.
A fun note, by the way, during Hunt's memories, he talks about the failed rebellion and their defeat at Mount Hermon. Hermon in German means soldier, and Hermon in the Old Testament refers to a sacred mountain.
Oh, that's interesting. That is a fun fact.
I thought it was a fun fact.
I want to circle back a little bit to Bryce and Hunt kind of relating to one another. And, you know, like, they have so much in common here. And I think another thing that's going to bring them closer is the concept of blame. Mm-hmm. So right now, Bryce blames Briggs, rightfully so, for, I mean, not rightfully so. He was innocent. What am I saying? But Bryce blames Briggs. Say that three times fast.
Bryce blames Briggs. No, can't do it.
And as she discovers the truth about Danica, she's going to start blaming herself more.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think there's plenty of what ifs that we talked about. What if I did this? What if I was more fae than I am a human? Like, all these other things. But then it's going to become, Danica didn't trust me. Danica was keeping secrets. What did I do to make my best friend not think that she could trust me with her life? And it's going to be the same way that Hunt blames himself for being part of the Fallen. And for leading everyone to be part of the Fallen, and then constantly working to get himself out of that situation and, you know, the mistakes that he makes later on in this book. So I think that we're going to see a lot more parallels between the two.
I agree.
Good point. Because it's both of us just agreeing with each other.
Yeah. We're just reinforcing each other's points.
Hyping each other up.
As we do. We do it so well. We learn a little bit more about Shahar and Sandriel, the archangels, and Shahar being Hunt's former lover. I wonder to what extent, knowing that Shahar went into rebellion because she believed Sandriel killed their parents, and then Sandriel kills Shahar. It felt very Cain and Abel to me, mm-hmm. which is a story both in the Christian and Hebrew Bible, and it's in the Quran. Like, the three, you know, the three major religions, quote unquote, all have the same story. And brother killing brother, sister killing sister, it does feel very
biblical
to me. And the reason for that also is because Micah tells Hunt a death for a death.
Yeah.
For everyone who died on Mount Hermon, you have to kill someone for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, which is the Mosaic law, the law of Moses. So feels very biblical. And that's all I have to say. I have no point other than to point that out.
Well, it also just kind of highlights how cruel it all is, too. Like, that's like hard. It's messed up. Like, these stories aren't fun. And I know that there are people who believe in these, and I don't want to belittle them or anything like that. It, like, they're just hardcore. Like, they're, you know, like, these are intense deaths. And even the way that Micah is described, right, that he is a king among angels and law unto himself, like, that's, it's grander, like, it's you know, it's bigger than anything. So I think that by doing this and adding all of these like religious biblical references, I think it's kind of adding higher stakes to everything. You know, like, we just came from two other series, right? ACOTAR, Throne of Glass. Now you have things where it feels like you're dealing with literal gods at this point.
I think that's an excellent point, because even if the stakes aren't higher for us, we can feel the stakes being higher for the characters.
Yeah.
That whether or not it's true, whether or not Micah's really a god, the fact of the matter is he is so powerful, he might as well be a god. And that's terrifying. How do you deal with someone with that much power?
I don't know. I feel like I could figure it out. I think that it also has, you know, there's that concept that people talk about, like, in their books, like, ultimate power corrupts ultimately, right?
Yeah, absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
One of those words, you know, one of them. But I feel like that's not even the question here.
Yeah.
I feel like the question is, what happens when the absolute power was always corrupt?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. I agree. What happens when the ultimate power, the absolute power, the higher power
was never good?
Yeah. It's all built on a foundation of lies, of oppression,
of death. Like, you know, Hunt tried to rise up for a quote unquote good reason. I think it all feels like a lie, you know, where it's like, I think she killed our parents. It's like, no, she didn't.
I'm going to talk about that later.
Oh, are you? Okay.
I can't remember if I mention it in the breadcrumbs or in a different chapter, but I do pose a question somewhere in here. Was Shahar really leading a rebellion for the reasons Hunt believes?
Not at all.
Or was it manipulation?
I am excited for when we get to that point, because I don't believe anything.
Yeah.
Mainly because I've learned SJM enough.
And Hunt is so biased. He's always biased.
He's like, you're pretty. And you'll let me in between your legs. I will do whatever you want.
Yeah.
I am in love.
When Hunt is thinking about Shahar and Sandriel, when he recalls them fighting right before Shahar's death, he thinks, quote, they were so nearly identical in face and build and fighting technique that it was like watching someone battle their reflection. When Hunt goes to the bathroom to shower and wash off all the blood, he sees himself in the mirror and sees, quote, the being who stared back was as bad as a reaper, worse. And it makes me wonder if one of the themes for this novel, in addition to those that we've identified, is battling your own internal, you know, Sandriel, basically.
Yeah.
Right. Your alter ego.
Yeah.
The Umbra Mortis is Hunt's alter ego, and he doesn't necessarily like the Umbra Mortis.
I mean, at the end of the day, like, the Umbra Mortis is still who he is, regardless of whether he wants to be it or not.
Right.
You know? So it's like, yeah, it's, I like that. I like that a lot. Good job.
Thanks. We learn that Hunt has to make up for 2,217 lives lost.
Every time there's numbers, I don't even look into it, because I know you're going to bust out some angel numbers.
Yeah. Apparently there's, I mean, how many freaking angel numbers are there? According to Google, it's 0 to 999, but also online it says 2,217 as an angel number centers around personal growth and development. So I don't know what to believe. I mean, it could just be combining the meaning of 22 and of 17. Whatever. Anyway, let me move on to my unhinged theory that
I'm excited.
So we learn in this chapter that Hunt's first name is actually Orion, which is the name of the constellation of Orion the Hunter. That's why his nickname is Hunt.
Mm-hmm. Also the name of the cat in Men in Black.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause he's wearing a galaxy on his necklace.
On his belt. Yeah.
So Orion is a constellation, and that's in our world, too.
Mm-hmm.
What's the name of another constellation? Canis Major. And in Canis Major, there's the star called Sirius. Sirius is the dog of Orion the Hunter. Sirius is also the name of the dead Asteri, who we know is female.
Do we know that's their name?
We do. It was like in chapter 2 or 3.
Wait. Okay. Continue.
What if Hunt's mother is the dead Asteri, quote-unquote dead Asteri, who went into hiding but was later found and killed by the Asteri?
Oh, my God.
Or perhaps went into hiding again. Like, it cannot be coincidence that Orion and Sirius are the hunter and the hunter's dog. Sirius is the Asteri's, dead Asteri's name, and Hunt's name is Orion. And he doesn't look like other angels or have the same power as other angels.
And, you know, people listening to this might have read the third book by now, and they're either screaming at you being a genius or
laughing.
Yeah.
But that's my unhinged theory, folks.
I love it. Good job.
At the end of the chapter, Hunt takes a shower after his killing spree to wash away the blood. And it feels like a moment where he's seeking absolution. Like, this is how he seeks for repentance, because he, quote, submits himself to the relentless burning. And it's just sad because this is obviously his ritual every time after he's been the Umbra Mortis. But it doesn't work until Bryce is there to help him.
My slightly different approach is, you know, looking at it in the form of self-harm, too.
Yeah.
You know, like punishment. Yeah. I mean, kind of like what you're saying of, like, you know, washing away the sins. But I think that this is like, I can also see this as being self-harm. It's because I saw a TikTok one time of a therapist being like, do you ever take a really, really hot shower to the point where it's like scolding after a hard day? That's self-harm. I was like, what?
I mean, you're completely right. It's like self-flagellation, essentially, which some people view as a form of repentance, however, is self-harm.
And it is that blurry line.
It is.
Well, is it that blurry? It's a line.
There's a line in there somewhere.
Yeah.
We return to Bryce's point of view in chapter 10, and we find her waiting on a fae couple who are browsing the antiquity gallery she works in. From a writing perspective, I actually think this scene is really clever. As the fae couple looks at various pieces of art, Bryce is able to recount, like, where that art is from and the civilization it's related to.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually isn't a ton of information, but what it does to me is showing the breadth and depth of the world and its history. And it makes me believe that, yes, this world is 15,000 years old or older. Like, the Asteri have been there for 15,000 years. So I think SJM does a really good job with that.
I agree. Like, it's, you also kind of get figure out dynamics too. Like, there's arranged marriages, you know, but at the same time, you kind of have a say in it because the fae woman just kind of complains, like, never do that again.
Yeah.
Like, I really want that woman's story.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked her for no reason. No, I have my reasons. Like, she kind of shaded the guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she walked off. Like, I want her story. But I also think it gives an opportunity for Bryce to differentiate herself again mm-hmm. and other herself, mm-hmm. right? So she says, quote, given the couple's attire, she doubted they appreciated the thumping bass of her morning workout mix. Hmm. You don't know their music choice.
Yeah.
And it's like, I know that that's one of those, you know, you're kind of be like, oh, they're so preppy and prissy. They wouldn't understand me and my, like, what music are you listening to, Bryce? What's so hardcore?
Yeah.
Also, we all know that like ridiculously rich person that's like, I listen to the most intense music ever. And you're like, shut up. But everyone, music's so universal.
It is. It is.
Also, going into this chapter, we're going to be talking, or we, me, but you too, talking a lot about smiles. And smiles are described often, I think, in like very masculine or feminine terms. Mm-hmm. So you'll say things like, pretty smile, or mm-hmm. just like the concept of women smiling. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you have to smile if you're a woman. Otherwise, you know, you should smile more. But if you smile as a woman, then you're confused as flirting, mm-hmm. which I was recently, despite me actively telling him, I'm not smiling at you because I'm flirting with you. And he goes, are you sure?
Oh, you told me this.
Yeah.
Story.
And I was like, as I was smiling widely, I'm sure. But then you also have like boyish smiles, mm-hmm. roguish smiles. Mm-hmm. So I think that smiles is an interesting concept when you think about it, because it can be very feminine and very masculine.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that when we enter, so the first line in this chapter is, you know, Bryce kept a smile plastered on her face, and it's like an immediate, it's an immediate shield. It's a mm-hmm. guard. It's now a weapon, a feminized weapon again, because it's her sweet feminine smile, because we have to.
And later it's going to be called saccharin,
mm-hmm.
which is too sweet.
Yeah. We'll see smiles weaponized between Hunt and Bryce mm-hmm. also back and forth. Like, they're both kind of like, they're both busy out-smiling one another.
Yeah. It's so funny.
And I'm just imagining, like, Isaiah in the corner, you're, like, watching them, and they're both, like, two people just smiling aggressively. Like, oh my God, are you okay? And, you know, Bryce will be the clear winner of the smile contest. And also, like, you know, you mentioned Lilac earlier. And we get that lilac moment here because mm. Hunt walks up to the threshold and he's like, hey, I smell lilac and I smell nutmeg. So I also did that, you know, Googleage, and lilac, you know, spirituality. Nutmeg is also meant to strengthen spirituality too.
Mm.
That's all. I mean, we can look into it as like, you know, and then of course Hunt's the one that's going to be the one to help give her energy spiritually. If you want to say her powers are spiritual,
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
know, lightning, boom,
or
boom.
They're connected on a spiritual level,
which is a mate level. Yeah. But you know what? We're not here to give you those answers. We're here to just randomly Google things for you.
Yep. That's right. So you don't have to do the work.
Yeah.
Except when we ask you to, because we couldn't.
Then please do.
When Isaiah and Hunt show up at the gallery, Bryce refuses to acknowledge them at first or let them in. And when she finally does acknowledge them through the intercom, she says to them, I didn't order pizza, which I love. It is such a power move against law enforcers. Just putting them down like,
mm-hmm.
you're my bitch. You know, like, you're here because I need something.
That just reminds me real fast. One time, I was in college and the police called my mom's phone or something like that. And I don't know why. I can't remember what it was. But I answer the phone. And they're like, this is officer blah, blah, blah. I need to speak to Maria. And I was like, okay. I didn't even like say anything. Mom, the popo's on the phone. And I handed it over. And I guess like the officer was like, please tell her that is officer popo to her.
Oh my gosh.
it's just the like troll people.
Yeah, well,
and to their ultimate amount.
Absolutely. And that's Bryce's philosophy, right? Troll the people who think they have power over me,
mm-hmm.
because it aggravates them and throws them off their game. And that is what Bryce is doing. She's using humor as a weapon. Also, pizza. It's not even like fine dining takeout. It's pizza. It's probably Little Caesars. It just lowers their status.
No.
I love Little Caesars. Don't get me wrong, but it's a $5 pizza.
Oh, you're right. And she didn't order it.
Yeah.
Bryce would order like Danielle's.
That's right.
Yeah.
Hunt's reaction is this, quote, despite himself, despite the mental clock ticking away, Hunt choked on a laugh. this is a signal to me that they have the same sense of humor. He's just reluctant to give over his power. However, he's still susceptible to it because ultimately he has no friends and he doesn't make jokes with anyone. He's craving connection. Yeah. And the fact that he can laugh at something like, I didn't order pizza, shows how desperate he is for connection.
I want friends. That was funny. I'll be your friend.
Kind of. Please.
That was hilarious. I'll laugh at whatever you say. Please like me.
I'll go get you pizza if you want pizza.
Do you like Little Caesars? I have a discount.
He's like a nervous chihuahua now.
Just a little chihuahua with wings. Please, please, please. Love me.
I think, though, Hunt resents this moment of connection or this, like, signal that they could connect. Because what does he do? He goes to the extreme to be as judgy as possible of Bryce.
God, yeah.
It's so bad. And he does it, in my mind, to ward off any potential connection that they might have.
Mm-hmm.
At this moment, we're reminded of Hunt's starting assumption of Bryce. He tells Isaiah, quote, she's a spoiled party girl. Isaiah responds, she's not stupid. But Hunt disagrees. Everything I've seen and heard suggests otherwise. And honestly, for the next 100 pages or so, Bryce is going to do things to reinforce this view. And it's difficult for Hunt to look past evidence that is right in front of him that states the complete opposite. It's a detriment to their eventual connection, but Hunt has to go through this process, unfortunately, because it's 200 years. No yeah. friends.
No, none of the friends. I feel like Hunt understands Bryce less now than he did that first night.
Because
mm-hmm. if you remember, Hunt was the one, like during the night of Danica's death, he's the one who calmed Bryce down.
Mm-hmm.
And like, okay, we talked about it. We're like, okay, there's that mate connection that maybe they couldn't really explore. So it was like, what's different? What's changed?
Mm-hmm.
And I go back and forth on this idea. So hear me out. What if Hunt is lashing out at Bryce for letting Micah live and saving him?
Mm, okay.
Not that we would know what would happen to Hunt afterwards. Like, I think he even mentions, like, it would go to whoever's next in charge.
Yeah.
But he also talks a lot about, like, daydreaming of killing Micah.
Yeah.
So here was an actual opportunity. Micah could have been way dead.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't do that. Like, it didn't happen. Like, Bryce saved him. So I just, because it feels like he's being purposefully mean. And I agree. I think a lot of it is also like his connection. Like, he's like, ooh, my loins. But like, I gotta be mean. I don't want to feel those feelings again. But I'm wondering if there's like at least a percentage there that resents her.
I think so. And I think this goes back to the idea of self-flagellation and punishment, because Hunt hasn't had any connection to anyone in mm-hmm. 200 years. He is a terrible being that is basically an assassin, not even a paid assassin, a slave assassin.
Yeah.
Who has to kill others in really terrible ways. So Hunt, in his own mind, doesn't deserve anything that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't deserve any sort of connection, good or bad. And I think he's taking anger out on Bryce in this moment because he was good and dissociative
yeah.
not that long ago.
And right? now here he is laughing about pizza.
Right, exactly. That's a far cry from the man who couldn't even view a human as human.
Yep.
And maybe he's not mentally prepared to step back into himself at this point. But Bryce is really good at getting reactions out of people. And she doesn't balk at his anger either. Quote, Hunt pushed off the parked car and stalked toward her, his gray wings flaring, which we know is him about to, like,
be throw real it serious. Down. Oh, yeah. He's got his serious wings on.
Yeah.
Angry chihuahua.
Angry chihuahua. Quote, a flick of Bryce's amber eyes took in Hunt. Her smile grew. See you in 3 weeks, she said cheerfully, and slammed the door shut. Hunt cleared the street in a matter of steps. Lightning wreathed Hunt's wrist as he pounded into the intercom button. As Jack mentioned, this is the complete opposite of how Hunt and Bryce reacted in the interrogation room the night of Danica's death. Like, at one point, he reached out, like, kindly
mm-hmm.
to check on her. And all of this, like I said, I think there are reasons, but I think from SJM's point of view, I think it's throwing us off the mate scent.
Mm-hmm.
Like trying to throw off the idea that we might have had during the interrogation scene where he was being protective and whatnot. All of that's gone.
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to think about like when I first read this, right? Like my initial reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think if I remember how I felt with that, where yeah. I did feel it being very jarring of like, oh, okay, so now we have this attitude and everything. But is it throwing us off the scent, mate? Or is it making us feel like, yes, they're going to get together?
I think I could see it being both.
Yeah.
Because there's an undeniable attraction, and I'm going to get into that in a little mm-hmm. bit. However, the whole community questions at the end of Sky and Breath, are they actually mates?
But that's not because of what we saw. That's because of SJM. That is a trap she did to us.
Yeah, that is a pattern trap that yeah. she put us through. However, I think it's less obvious here than it's been with any other of her series.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is the first time she's building a friendship.
Yeah.
As much as she wants to say that Reese and Feyre were friends first.
Yeah. Or even Aelin and Rowan.
They were hardly friends first. They were, yeah.
No.
They had to build a connection of black eyes.
And beating each other up.
Yeah.
I don't know why this really stuck out to me. And this is a complete tangent. But the carpets in the gallery are green. And it was so weird to me because it's like pine green and it seems like it could be grass
mm-hmm.
and everything's like wood. It's when
it feels tacky.
It feels extremely tacky, maybe from the 80s, but also feels like it's trying to be an enchanted forest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So one of our listeners looking at their green carpet being like, wait a minute. Trust, I'm sure your green carpet is lovely, but what I'm imagining for Jessica's, which is a shame because I imagine her being a classy broad.
Exactly. But I have a theory in the breadcrumbs about Jessica, and I think it lends itself into why her carpet is green.
Okay. Thank you for listening to part one of this week's episode of Book Talk for Book Talk. We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform. Tune in Thursday for part two, where we finish covering this week's chapters.
We would love to hear your thoughts based on today's conversation. You can submit your comments to our form at booktalkforbooktalk.com for a chance to have your feedback discussed during a future mini episode.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please visit our website, booktalkforbooktalk.com, to view our latest merch and learn about supporting the show through Patreon, Ko-Fi, or Venmo.
Bye.